Welcome to API's monthly teleclass. We're delighted to have Jan Hunt on the call. Barb Nicholson and I, Luminescian, are going to be with Jan for about an hour, and we're thrilled because Jan is just a true advocate, and she has such a heart for children, and she counsels people from all over the world. She just really understands the heart of attachment, and she is the author of three books, The Natural Child, Parenting from the Heart, A Gift for Baby, and the co-editor with her son of the Unschooling Unmanual. I love that title. I love that title. So, Jan, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Now, the teleseminar is called tonight Balancing Parent and Child Needs So Everyone Thrives. And I know Barb certainly has a lot to say about that, given, you know, the marvelous experience that led her to found Attachment Parenting International with Lisa Parker. Why don't we begin with your sort of definition of the idea of balancing? You know, balancing, we hear so much from the culture about it, but it's probably a very different interpretation culturally than what really the essence of that word means in our context.
Okay. Yes, I've been thinking about the title because I was a little worried about it. Actually, I thought it might be a bit misleading because it would be, you know, in an ideal world, there would always be balance. We would give love to our child. We would get, you know, meet their needs, and our needs would be met too. And I would be able to tell my clients, you know, in whatever situation they were in, this is how you can meet your child's needs, and your needs will be met too. And I try to do that, but that's just not the reality, because they're children and they can't always meet our needs, and the situation can't always meet our needs. Mm-hmm. But so I wanted to talk about the two different ways that things can get balanced. They can get balanced immediately, or they can get balanced later. And once I realized that they can get balanced later, then I stopped worrying about the title. But so the immediate ways, the best example, of course, the easiest one would be a hug. You know, you give your child a hug, you get a hug simultaneously. So that meets their needs and it meets your need too. I can give another longer example from my own parenting. When I first decided to co-sleep with Jason, he's 28 now, but I still remember vividly the first few nights that we, when he was born, we had him, we didn't know about co-sleeping. We had him in a bassinet next to our bed. We actually got lucky because we had a very small house, and the room that we had set up and decorated beautifully for the, quote, nursery, was set up in such a way that I could not see the crib from our bed. And even though I didn't know about co-sleeping or attachment parenting, I knew that I just wouldn't be able to sleep myself unless I knew that he was okay all night. So we never did put him in the crib. In fact, we ended up taking the crib back to the store. But we did put him in a bassinet next to the bed on the floor. And that's where he was for the first few nights. And he, all night long, he was making all these funny noises. He was spitting and coughing and sneezing and moaning and crying, and just all night long. And so it was our first child, only child. And so we assumed that was normal. And I figured, okay, that's why we hear so much that new parents can't get any sleep, mm-hmm. because their child is making noise all night long. And so then I got lucky, because then about the fourth day, someone had given me The Family Bed book by Tina Thevenin. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even want to read it because I was horrified by it, just by the title. I thought, oh, because I thought you could, and I thought it was fatal, you know, that you're taking a chance with your child's life and all of this. And I was completely misinformed on that. But I, around the fourth day, I guess I needed something to read while I was nursing, and I reached to our bookshelf, and I got that book, and I got curious. I started reading it, and the very first chapter completely turned me around, totally. Not just on co-sleeping, but on meeting Jason's needs, on knowing that I wouldn't need to punish him. I had been worried about that because I knew that I didn't ever want to. It just completely turned me around. We have that first chapter on our website now.
You know, let me jump in here because I think this is fascinating. Mm-hmm. Anybody who knows your work and who's gone to your fantastic award-winning site, naturalchild.org, knows that, you know, knows your philosophies and knows how deeply you understand not just the research and the science, but the experience of what all of this looks like and sounds like in our parenting. And I think it's fascinating and very reassuring for parents out there who, you know, a lot of parents say, well, you know, Martha Sears or Jan Hunt or even, you know, because they know Barb and Lisa's story. So they, Barb and Lisa have talked so much about how they first started out and they felt alone and then they found each other. But I think it's reassuring to hear from advocates like you who do this kind of work that you could be turned around in a chapter. Like you didn't believe in it, and you can, and so this is, I think this is empowering because it show, it speaks to the power of a shift, literally, overnight. I mean, you can be moved by reading something that goes, wait a minute.
Right.
This makes
sense.
Well,
you know, Tina Thevenin is such a great writer, and she just made it so crystal clear and just reassured me about the safety issue that I'd had. She reassured me about just in general about meeting the child's need, you know, is fine. It's not only okay, but it's wonderful and beneficial.
Yeah.
But you were giving this as an example of balance too, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So I read that chapter and that was like, and I showed it to Marcus and he liked it too. We were fortunate that we never had any differences, on parenting issues. So we put him in our bed that same night after I read that chapter. And he was completely quiet all night. He didn't make a peep. You know, he may have started to cry a little bit before nursing, but I just remember that it was such a beautiful, quiet, peaceful night. And he woke up with a smile on his face.
Mm-hmm. And you must remember that so vividly. What did you glean from that? What was the insight, the big aha?
Well, it was that was the first time among many, many times that Jason taught me about attachment parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Jason has just all these years, and still now, he's 28, he's still teaching me in so many ways what love is and what it looks like, what it feels like. How to give it, how to receive it. It's just
well,
been
and
beautiful.
I think that is beautiful, and I think that actually is a wonderful way to segue to this point, which is when so many parents feel out of balance, let's talk, I mean, I'd just love to hear how you talk with some parents about how to meet their own needs. How do they find that love for themselves so that they can receive their children in that way?
It's a leap of faith, I guess, isn't it? Because if a parent has not had the benefit of watching a loving parenting in their own childhood or has not had the benefit of discovering the right teachers like I did with that book, it's not their fault. I think that's what I want to say most of all. It's not their fault that they're doing things that may not be the best way to go about parenting. And every parent is doing the very best they can at every single moment. That's one of the first things I always tell a client on the very first phone call is that if they think about the kind of love that they want to give their child and the kind of understanding that they want to present to that child, to give the same love and understanding to themselves. They really believe that the child is doing the very best he can at every moment, and so are they.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's so hard for so many parents to accept. And there's so many years, so many neural pathways of them doubting that very thing.
Right.
Let's take the idea of balance and kind of break it down to the various aspects of balance. And I know, Barb, you know, this would be a great time for anyone who hasn't heard sort of the way that you came to found API with Lisa is precisely because of balance issues.
Well, that's one of them. It's kind of a complex story, but,
sure.
You know, just the obvious experiences that we all have as new parents and the challenges we get from the mixed messages in our culture. I know for me, going to La Leche League was a huge turning point because I, for the first time, was around a room full of breastfeeding mothers who were really going a lot on intuition and instinct.
Sure.
You know? And that was a part of it. But another reason I think that Lisa and I bonded so much was that we were both special ed teachers.
Right.
And I know Jan talks a lot about this in The Natural Child, about the problem with labeling so many children with so-called learning disabilities.
Right.
And she and I both were completely distraught about the system. And we had been, you know, teaching children that obviously did not have a true disability, that there was nowhere to plug these children, you know, to get them special help. And so the system labels them something to get them special attention, which is admirable. And I love the children that I worked with, but I saw the damage of that label.
And look where it's gone.
Oh, I know.
It's
mushroomed into so many categories. And they just, the frustration with that made us want to work on the prevention end.
Uh-huh.
I just did not want to go back into that system.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to empower parents to take back their intuitive knowing their child and to find the best fit for them. If it might be school, it might be homeschooling. Lisa and I both have done many different configurations with our own children. And if it wasn't for that kind of empowerment through that attachment parenting process, I don't know if I would have had the courage to, you know, turn my back on a system that I had been a part of, you know.
Well, and it's, I think it speaks to a different kind of balance. I think it speaks to a much more abstract but maybe very profound, and that is the idea of balancing our convictions, our deep courage with the environment that we're in.
Right.
So that it isn't just about balancing, you know, our culture talks so much about balancing and a schedule and balancing, you know, different people's needs in the family. That seems to be, for me anyway, the most superficial way of looking at it. And I'd love, Jan, for you to sort of talk about the idea of developing conviction as new parents. How can, you know, you shed some light on this for people listening about, they have the gut feeling that they believe that they're parenting, you know, in the way that their child needs. Then there are all the voices. There's the extended family. Maybe they're not on the same page with a spouse. And so balancing the voices, let's start there.
Oh. Yeah, that's interesting. That's another interesting way of looking at balance. And when I'm talking with my clients, I'm always recommending support groups, because even if you can find only one like-minded person, like Barb did, there's a huge, huge difference between zero and one there.
Yeah.
Especially in this country. The U.S. is one of the most difficult countries to raise a child because of all those voices surrounding us. It's very, very difficult to trust yourself when everyone else is saying something different. So I always remind people that, you know, it's different in other cultures. There are other cultures where practically every family co-sleeps. You know, there are other cultures that have, many countries now have banned spanking, for example. But this country is we're going to be last on that. We're going to be last on a lot of those issues.
And I had read that it was the U.S. and Somalia. Like Sweden,
yeah, exactly.
79, which seems like eons and eons ago, but they certainly knew something that this country still doesn't believe yet.
Yeah, I mean, in most countries, you can't, at least you can't spank in schools, but in this country, still many states, that's still legal. So this country is very, very difficult, especially with everyone being separated from their families, even if you do see eye to eye, often at a distance. So it's really important to look around or find a support group or start a support group so that you can have that kind of help and reassurance. And I've had numerous stories from people who couldn't find a support group but decided with my urging, and decided to try to start one. And they were, one person was sure there wouldn't be anyone because her town was so small and she knew everybody. And the other one was sure that no one would show up because she was in a quite a mainstream area. And both of them were just amazed that people showed up at these meetings that they didn't know. One of them said, a lady showed up and who lived right around the corner from her. They just had never met. So, you know, sometimes it's just putting an ad out there and letting people know that this is available, and they'll show up.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned before you used a very charged word, separation, and I know you didn't mean to use it in a charged way, but that leads me to a question that we received for you, and it's a new mom who had a baby just a few weeks ago. I think the baby might be 12 weeks, maybe mm-hmm. just that first 3 months, and she has gone back to work as a school psychologist. And her email was really a question about, I think she's looking for some kind of reassurance, but this mm-hmm. is the question. I recently returned to work after a 12-week maternity, and I'm really struggling with the decision, especially in light of the economy. My primary concern is being away from my baby full-time during the school year and the impact that has on attachment and cognitive development. I've read the research and understand the first year of life is so critical for development, specifically for being in close proximity to the primary caregiver. We're trying to balance our work schedules and high-quality daycare. And she describes the high-quality daycare in parentheses, low teacher-infant ratio, low staff turnover, staff continuing education, quick response to infant needs, and our work schedule, which is only 200 days and has many breaks. And she says, unfortunately, there isn't any research that directly measures our situation to help guide our decisions. We're having to use what is out there and make it fit. With your experience and expertise, do you think working a school schedule has the same deleterious effects on attachment and cognitive development as working a full-time, year-round job?
Mm. Well, I'm really sensing a lot of frustration on her part that she's really torn, or she wouldn't have sent in this email, right? She's found what she thinks is or feels is the best solution, but she also knows and has read material that makes her question her decision. And it really ties into what we were just talking about, that in this country, children are not respected, their needs are not recognized. If they were, our government would give subsidies to women for the first 3 years, so they wouldn't need to work for financial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And it would actually save money long term for the country. There would be, you know, far fewer physical and mental illnesses, and there would just be, it would save tremendously in our economy. But of course, our government, people in government are usually there for just 4 years, 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and they don't see past their own term. Very, very rare to have a government look at the long-term effort. Dr. Elliot Barker has written a lot about this. We have some of his articles on our website. It's really sad because someone like this who has read, is concerned, obviously, knows that she might be causing some problems, although there's no way to measure that. How can we measure that? But it's really frustrating to me that our country is in this, that we're in this situation we are now, especially in this recession, that so many women feel that they have no choice.
Yeah.
You know, what is the choice?
Well, let's provide whatever reassurance we can, maybe by reinforcing the idea of the stability of the caregiver.
Right.
Because I think that there is a silver lining wherever we are. We can try to sort of lift her up wherever she is. So, your thoughts on
mm-hmm.
maybe giving her, because she is looking for guidance too. She said that she's looking for some guidance. So maybe are there some questions that you can ask her? And if you're on the call, this is directed to the person who sent the email. If you are listening on the call tonight, please email letthebabydrive@yahoo.com. That's letthebabydrive@yahoo.com. I have my laptop here, and so Jan Hunt, who is our special guest tonight, and of course Barb Nicholson, are here to field your calls. So anybody who is listening who has a question for Jan, please email letthebabydrive@yahoo.com. So go ahead, Jan.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about daycare. A lot of people assume, as I assumed before I started reading Peter Cook's work, that the problem was that it wasn't the mom. And then I started reading Dr. Cook's articles and book and his book, and I realized that that's not the main issue, because really we've been around for, what, 200,000 years. For most of those years, I mean, we're modern years, our modern age is very recent. For most of that time, for hundreds of thousands of years, we lived in small communities, 50 or 80 or so families. We, who obviously knew our child from birth, every mom in that community would have all of the other moms around and dads around who could take over if she was ill or tired or busy or whatever. And I'm sure that was fine, you know, and the baby's needs would be met because the baby was not losing anybody. Well, most of those communities, and when we discover Stone Age tribes now, they don't have a word for stranger. They only know themselves. No one ever leaves. No one ever enters. So they know each other from birth. It could hardly be any different from what we have now. And especially from what we have now in usual daycare situations where they pay very little and the people are, you know, there's high turnover, and the baby can bond with a caregiver and then lose her and then bond with the next caregiver and lose her and so on. And at some point, and it would vary, of course, to the baby, but at some point that baby is going to start protecting themselves against loss.
Yeah.
It's almost like they're saying to themselves, I'm not going to allow myself to love that much because it hurts so much when I lose it. And that is, as Peter Cook often says, you know, that is the essential problem with daycare.
Mm-hmm.
It's the loss of love.
Isabel Fox calls it caregiver roulette.
Yeah.
Isabel Fox called it caregiver roulette. You know, and you're talking, Jan, about the loss of trust, and I think that's so powerful. I don't think there's a person listening, you know, let alone in this country. It's such a malaise of this culture, this loss of trust. And so what can this this mom and every mom in that situation do to ensure that that loss of trust doesn't happen? I mean, short of being there and watching, or hiring her own nanny.
Well, there are a number of different possibilities that I've seen moms do. I've seen moms who go on welfare so that they can stay with their child at home. A lot of moms would not want to do that. Some moms find a young adult in their community who can come to their home so that the child is not leaving their home and stay with the mom, stay with the child while the mom works. Hopefully more and more working places will allow babies and toddlers to come to work with the mom. A lot of moms are starting their own business so that they can have their child with them all the time. So there are just a number of different options depending on the situation.
I just got an email that the mother who wrote that email is listening. If there are any questions that you have, I'm speaking to you. I don't know if you want me to use your name, so I'm just saying that the mom who wrote the email, please do email letthebabydrive@yahoo.com and ask Jan Hunt or Barb anything you'd like about the specific situation. And so the idea of a stable caregiver, I think it's, again, another silver lining, another piece of reassurance that especially because we're always reminding AP moms they don't have to do it perfectly. It's not about a set of ideals. I know Barb and Lisa for years, you know, have worked so hard to remind parents there is, it's not a storybook. This isn't, mm-hmm. there's no perfect way of doing this. So this woman has gone back to work. Okay. But boy, she misses this, her baby, and she knows better because she knows the psychology of it. She knows the cognitive development. So if she suspects, what kinds of signs might she look for in her baby in the absence of having any information about what's happening at daycare?
Well, first of all, she should have information. Any parent who puts a child in a daycare situation should spend at least 2 days as a visitor.
So
actually
can you
watching,
find out,
seeing,
for example, can you find out who specifically will be with my baby and can I ask that this person stay with my baby?
And have an interview with that person and ask them how they would handle specific situations.
Have an interview with that person. And can she also say, would you give me a heads up and let me know if that person plans to be leaving?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that I often recommend to moms is to have a mother's helper. I had one when Jason was three. Even though we were totally planning to homeschool and had started a homeschool support group, but I was an older mom, and Jason was a very, very active little boy, always climbing and always talking and asking questions. And so when he was three, I caught myself looking in the yellow pages under preschools, just to have a break. And I had to laugh. I mean, there was no way that I would ever put him in a preschool. But I took that as a red flag that, you know, I had to do something. And so I talked about it at the next homeschool meeting, and they suggested a mother's helper. I didn't even know what that was. And they said, that's a like a babysitter, but you're home. And one of the moms volunteered her own daughter, who was only 11 then, but I would be home. And even though she was 11, she had four younger siblings already, so she had a lot of experience. Because she was 11, she was still a child herself and able, you know, interested in playing with Jason a lot. And she also didn't charge very much, and she was homeschooling, so she was available all the time. And it was just a godsend. I mean, she was my mother's helper for the next 4 years. She was just on call, and I could call and say help, and she could come over for 20 minutes or for the afternoon or whatever, and I could finally take a shower or do the dishes. That's when I started writing articles, when I finally had a little time like that.
And when you could put your thoughts together.
Yeah, exactly.
So at the end of a thought.
So that's one thing that I always, you know, recommend to someone. But when I do tell people to, or when I do suggest a mother's helper, I always mention that that's one of the critical questions, is not just how would they handle crying or what do they believe about punishment and so on, but just as important is to find out, are they, you know, is their family, do you have any plans at all to leave the area?
And that's interesting. I doubt most people would even think to ask that question because they're not guided that way. And I think that's just makes so much sense to be able to ask that and mm-hmm. say, I really, you know, I really believe that this is one of the key points for me. If you have a lot of turnover, that's going to influence my decision.
Right. And not just leaving, but I later on had another young woman spend some time as a mother's helper with me. And she quit just suddenly with no explanation. And to this day, I wonder, you know, did I do something? But I don't know why she left, but she suddenly left. And Jason was older then and was constantly asking about her, when will he see her, and so on. So it's not just leaving the town, but to just let them know exactly that, you know, how traumatic that can be for a child. And do they have any plans? Are they going back to college? Is there anything that will interfere with them, with this position that they're taking?
Well, going back to this mother situation, that she's a 3-month-old.
Well, she said that she's done what she could, given that she has found no other choices. She's at least found a place that has low turnover, but I don't know, daycare centers being what they are, and they don't pay well, and they have young adults who are often changing their minds about what they want to do. So it's a risk.
Well, I think one thing that is helpful is if you go into the center and they've had a long-term employee, you know, that's mm-hmm. in that group, you know, that you can feel a little bit of comfort knowing that this person, you know, will probably be there,
right.
you know, for the long haul. They're committed. They've been there for many years. That's a good sign. And one thing I would have suggested to moms is they bring in a sling and they demonstrate the sling for the care provider and they talk about yes. how this can relieve them, you know, if they have, you know, several babies, that your baby just loves to be held
yeah.
and to teach them how to use it. And this has been wonderful for the caregivers, too, because they often don't know about slings.
Right, right.
So if they can bring yeah. some things from their attachment parenting philosophy into and explain to them this is a way that's going to help you and meet the needs of my child and
right.
And really become a team, really, you know, feel like that this
yeah.
person is an extended part of your family and like you were saying, Jan, spend days in there getting to know them and really getting a feel for is this the best situation
right.
for my child.
Yeah, and
yeah.
if they
yeah, don't take what they say at face value. I would
right.
check it out.
Mm-hmm. And if they're not amenable to that, to the watching, the supervising, the hanging around, if they're not amenable to it, then that, boy, that gives you information.
That's
right
a red flag.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking also, too, about, you know, when she mentioned low ratios, and it makes me think of the situation of balancing the needs of a family when we have more than one child. So this is, I think, a good time to kind of work in the whole idea of giving all siblings, giving all of our kids what they need at various stages of their development, balancing those developmental needs
mm-hmm.
So that everyone thrives. So why don't you help us explore that, Jan?
Well, I only have one.
mm-hmm.
So I don't know firsthand about siblings, but I do know from so many discussions I've had with moms that co-sleeping is real key to sibling cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
That siblings who co-sleep, I've heard such beautiful stories. They wake up and smile at each other. They hold hands, you know. I think, and I'd like to put in here, too, for that mom or anyone else in her situation, is that co-sleeping can go to some distance to repairing anything that's happened from the separation during the day.
Good point. Mm-hmm.
So I often highly, highly recommend co-sleeping to working moms.
Especially if they're breastfeeding, too. That's one way to keep their supply up.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Tonight,
right.
you know,
that's right.
Frequently at night. Yeah.
And Barb, seeing as you had more than one child, how did
mm-hmm.
you do the balancing of needs at various stages of your kid's development with your needs as well and your self-care?
Well, I love Dan.
Was there a time when someone or several people were not thriving, or one or two were thriving and somebody wasn't, or you were feeling like you had the proverbial, as our culture keeps emphasizing, the short end of the stick?
Oh, never. Poor boys, okay. So, it was ongoing challenge, always. But I think the key for me, personally, was support groups. I was one of these moms that would go to all the league meetings in town, morning group, night group. You know, bring my children with me. I just really needed that community of women. I was trying to build my own little tribe, you know, like Jan was describing. Just intuitively, I just knew that I needed to be around like-minded women, families that I could trust, that if my children went to play with their children, that they would be loved, they would be respected, mm-hmm. they wouldn't be spanked, or they wouldn't witness, you know, the other children getting, you know, harshly treated. Because as we know, even if you're not treated that way in your home, if you witness it, it's very distressing.
Mm-hmm.
And not that you can protect your children from that all the time, but just in general, I wanted the you know, home environments that they're exposed to be, for the most part, respectful. And I became a Lahaitchi League leader. I was in a homeschooling co-op for a while. Just all those webs of support, you know, our church group, everybody that could keep me balanced, because I also knew that, you know, my children needed their own identities, not just, you know, their four brothers that, you know, are in this family, but they all were so unique, different interests, different personalities, one so much into sports, one so much into art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very different. So it kept the sibling rivalry down to know that their needs were being respected, and, you know, we would find activities that they were interested in. But it was a lot of, I want to say work, but, you know, just a lot of
careful
thought. You know?
Exactly. You know, it's a conscious vigilant
mm-hmm.
awareness of who's on second, who's on first, who's on third.
Right.
And less about taking inventory and more about taking stock and taking heed and really noticing. And so, Jen, you know, I'd love it if you could talk about balance in educating. You know, you have worked on this book with your son Jason, co-edited mm-hmm. The Unschooling Unmanual. And I would imagine you have a lot to say about balancing needs in terms of learning and creating a rich environment where
mm-hmm.
everybody's needs can be met.
Yeah. Well, unschooling is really the family unschooling. It's not just a child.
Mm-hmm.
I was there as his kind of reference librarian and alert to whatever his current interest was, because that's how we learn best, is what we're interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, no school teacher in any school could possibly know, let alone meet all of those children's curiosities. That's what we have in unschooling, is that we're always at any moment, we're always learning what he was interested in. And it might have been much earlier than he would have learned it in school, or much later. He taught himself squares and square roots at three. You know, I didn't say, well, you know, we have to wait a few years for that.
Mm-hmm.
He read a bit late, quote late, but it was on time for him. But it was just such a joy to learn right along with him all of these interesting things. Children have such interesting questions, much more than adults do. And he would just always, know exactly how best to get that information.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And we just got another email from, and this takes us in a little bit of a different direction, but I think it's very valuable, and I was hoping we would discuss this piece of balancing in this call. Hot emotions. Balancing our need for peace with a child's very natural expression of emotions. And so this is a kind of a different layer of balance. But the idea of just, I'd love you to talk, I know you do this so eloquently, and you and Barb, talking about, you know, not suppressing a child's
mm-hmm.
full range of emotion and finding
yeah.
balance in the chaos.
Okay. Well, that's what our society does wrong. Our society is always telling children to be good and smile, be happy. Don't be sad. You know, see a crying child, they say, don't be sad. There's nothing to be sad about. There's nothing to be angry about. Don't be angry. Nice little girls, don't show anger. You know, all of these kinds of messages are just permeating our culture. And it's really unfortunate. I still, myself, have difficulty sometimes even recognizing what my feeling is, let alone expressing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I have, you know, my parents were pretty good, you know, and loving parents, but they didn't know how to really listen for my feelings and respect them fully. So it really can have some very unfortunate results in adulthood. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to put that in later. This is one of the things that really needs to be put in, as Elliot Barker is always saying, in the first 3 years, to recognize, help the child to identify the feeling. You must be really angry that you knocked over your brother's blocks. Guess what the problem is. Are you still angry because he wouldn't play with you this morning? I would be angry too. Validate the feeling, identify the feeling, validate the feeling. And then the child can listen to what else you have to say. But you have to do that first. Mm-hmm. That's first.
Without putting words in the child's mouth.
Absolutely. Yeah. What do you think would help here? What would you like to do now? Maybe we all need a break. We're all getting a little excited.
Jan, of recognizing that you had a very, very active toddler and he needed to play, and mm-hmm. finding a solution for that, something that could meet his needs for active play.
Yeah, well, he was three. By the time he was three, I had read so many books. I'd been to 100 La Leche League meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't about to try to force him to not be active. Certainly, it was very obvious by then that he was simply being a three-year-old. I had to find solutions for myself. I couldn't, there was nothing wrong with Jason or his behavior. He was just being a three-year-old.
That gave you some peace.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
And I think that's the key.
Our society doesn't recognize that two-year-olds should act like two-year-olds and three-year-olds should act mm-hmm. like three-year-olds. They seem to believe that all children should act like they're 35. It's very unrealistic, and it's really had a lot of unfortunate ramifications, too.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to talk about a lot of the ways in which parents feel that they're out of balance. If we even just, remove the issue in terms of balancing needs with kids, I think about the age of distraction and just feeling mm-hmm. I look around and there is a terrible imbalance in many different ways, in the ways that people even just run their lives from the moment they wake up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what are some of the ways, Jan, that you, when you're counseling people, guide them back to this natural state? Your website, thenaturalchild.org, is not just, of course, based on the natural state of the child, but our
right.
child, our state as human
yeah.
beings. And so the idea of what is natural, given that we live in a society right now with such unnatural...
Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy world that we're in, and it's very difficult to find that kind of... first of all, it's hard to find time to oneself, mm-hmm. which is really important. That's where maybe a mother's helper could be useful. It's important to recognize that we have needs too. We have physical needs and emotional needs. And if they're not being met, then that's where we're in danger of taking that out on the child, or just not being alert enough or awake enough to be aware of what the child needs and to meet those needs.
Well, and also the idea that if we have suppressed or blocked off those needs because they're wrapped up in woundedness and that people are trying to avoid feeling, that they will cut off their own vulnerability and then not want to recognize that need in their child as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you make of the fact that so many moms or even parents in general, when you ask them about their needs, they shrug? They just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know. They can't put their finger on
Or they can put their finger on it, but they have no idea about how to get those needs met.
Yeah.
One other possibility I'd like to put in here is if someone is thinking, well, I'd love to have a mother's helper, but I just can't afford it, there is another option, and that is to find another mom in the same situation and switch. In other words, you would take your child and go to her house, and you would play with all the children and giving her time. And then she would come to your house and do the same for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's one way that there's no charge for that, of course.
Right.
It's a no cost thing. The important thing, of course, would be to find a parent of like mind who would be treating your child the way you would want them treated.
Mm-hmm. I remember being at a park a few years ago, about 4 years ago, and there were a number of women that I didn't know, and one woman showed up in jogging clothes or shorts, and she was only there for a couple of moments, and she came with her, I guess, a 3-year-old or 4-year-old girl, and within a few moments, she chatted with the women, and her girl stayed, and she left. And when she came back, by that point, I'd made some contact with the women, and they were acquaintances, and I said to her, "Did you just go for a jog?" And she said, "Yeah." I said, "Congratulations." Like,
yeah.
And she said, "If I don't do that, I'm just not right for the rest of the day. My head's not right."
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, good for you, and how rare it is to see somebody actually not feeling apologetic for doing that. I mean, we live in a culture where moms don't even want us to open the door with their strollers. They say, no, I got it.
Yeah.
This idea of we can't.
Yeah, the supermom. It's the supermom image. We should do everything. and you know, when we think about what I said earlier about, you know, what we had for hundreds of thousands of years, and we're about 180 degrees from that now. When I had my mother's helper for those 4 years, the mistake that I made was that I felt guilty that whole time. I thought I should be able to do this myself.
Let's talk about that. That's a huge piece that just doesn't seem to be going away. I don't think that a lot of women voice it. I think that if they do voice it, it's done almost as a satire. And then in some cases, I think now there seems to be this backlash against this perfect mommy era of books, and now there's even a book called Bad Mother, almost people being proud of their guilt, or as if it's a Purple Heart or badge of honor. So let's talk about that as another aspect of, you know, why guilt definitely keeps us out of balance, and how we might be able to use that guilt to realign ourselves.
Okay, well, the guilt comes from our culture, again. The more like-minded friends you can find in a support group or just in your community, the less I think there would be guilt, because you would be able to talk about that and get some reassurance that there's no reason for you to feel guilty. You're doing the very best you can. And I think that's the key. You know, we really have to recognize that none of us are perfect. As long as we do the very best we can at any given moment, given all of our experience and everything we know, and our current situation, and give love to ourselves like we're trying to give our children, then we'll be okay. But the guilt comes from all of this misinformation from our culture. You know, we have to recognize that most of the people in our country just don't understand these issues.
Well, and then there's all that, the whole childhood piece, which the, you know, our old stories constantly driving our perceptions and our behavior. And so balancing fantasy with reality, and balancing our fears with our courage, you know, to be able to take the fear and use it as a compass anyway, and say, well, what is it that I'm really feeling right now, and why did I react that way?
Yeah. One thing I'd like to say, though, is that attachment parenting works both ways. When you treat a child with kindness, it does something for you. You feel good. It feels good.
Mm-hmm.
When you hurt a child deliberately, it doesn't feel good, you know, to you or the child.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, attachment parenting brings its own rewards with it, either right then or later on.
It's like relational oxytocin.
Yeah, and I never really realized this until Jason became an adult, you know, and I'm looking back over the years, and I realized that we didn't have anything that could even begin to be called a problem after about age 7. The teenage years were complete, total joy. He is so kind now. He just was constantly looking for things he can do for me. He has started a business repairing computers, and we're in a very small community, so I often see his clients, and that's the very first thing they say to me is, oh, you're Jason's mom. He is the kindest person.
Mm-hmm.
So you get that later. So coming back to what I started talking about, is that sometimes the balance can take a while, but it's there. You know, it's never wasted. Any love that you give to a child, it doesn't just go to the child and end there. It reverberates, and you'll you'll find it later, and we'll go to other people too. You know, Jason's not going to be just kind to me, but to all of his clients, to everyone that he meets from now on, we'll reap those benefits. So it's almost like, you know, I put pennies in the first few years and getting millions of dollars now.
That's a nice way of putting it. You know, it's interesting. We hear from so many moms who are trying to hold themselves to a very high standard. And I think there's this they get thrown out of whack, their balance gets thrown out of whack when they're trying to adhere to some kind of a portrait that they think that they ought to be a certain way all the time, that they feel they ought to be more temperamentally stable than they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, API has 8 principles that they have based not just API on, but now Attached at the Heart, which is Lisa and Barb's new book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting. Whoever is listening, I'm sure that in the back of anyone's mind, and even if we could talk as a round forum, I'm sure we would hear from people who say, well, gosh, you know, I practice principle 2 and 6 and 3.
Yeah.
I'm not so good on 7 and 1. And so let's talk about
sure.
unrealistic expectations.
Yeah, it is unrealistic. Yeah. I first started thinking about this question when I wrote my article, What is Attachment Parenting? And I wrote it, and this is before I had the website, and I showed it to a close friend of mine that I'd met in the LA League. She was a league leader. And she was so surprised. She liked the article, but she was so surprised because she was expecting a laundry list, as she put it. And I hadn't said anything. And it never occurred to me when I was writing that article to even mention, you know, co-sleeping, natural weaning, and, you know, whatever. Because I was only talking about the feeling and the respect and the dignity that we should give our children. To me, that's attachment parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Because there could be good reasons for not doing any one of those things. You know, it's very rare, but some women just can't nurse. Some women have spouses who are adamantly opposed to co-sleeping and so on. So although that's the ideal, you know, but it's, at the same time, it's funny. I want to say both things. I want to say, you know, yes, that's the ideal, and everything that's on the API list is wonderful. I guess what I'm saying is that if for whatever reason you absolutely cannot do that, can't do numbers 3 and 7 or whatever, that all is not lost. Because what the child is mostly picking up on is how much you are on their side. Are you on their side?
Yeah, and I mean, this ties back to the daycare question that, you know, okay, it's not the way she would prefer it, which she would just probably love to be able to be home the whole time. But what, you know, what the guidance was, make sure that at least your baby has a sense of reliance and trust on who he or she is with. So, yeah, I think that what you're saying is the real world, I think.
Yeah, it's the real world. Make the best of what you are given. At the same time, though, I do want to put in to still stay creative. Keep in mind other options. That watch out for opportunities that might come up. Something might come up where she sees an opportunity to have a home business, for example.
Mm-hmm.
To stay open to those opportunities and not to just feel so frustrated that you've missed those opportunities.
That's a good point, Jan, because, you know, if she's a school psychologist, she has her PhD or at least her master's, and so she could easily become an educational consultant.
Like me.
I'm not saying she could just whip that into shape overnight, but it is something
that
we can reinvent ourselves. We can manifest these things based on how, you know, what we really feel deeply concerned about. So I think you're right. I think that I got a sense from her and other, you know, people who write in that certain situations may not feel like they're right on the edge of madness and sanity, but they just kind of feel like it's this little thing that's dogging them. It's bothering them, and they're not sure how it's all going to turn out.
Yeah. And since we use that as an example, that particular person as an example, I want to give one other example. I had a client who really didn't want to put her child into daycare, but she was going through a divorce and needing to work. And she only had a high school degree, but she was so determined that she wouldn't, you know, that she would keep her child with her, that she took a course to become a lactation consultant and takes her child with her to those appointments. So she was, I was there to just help her to be aware that there might be other opportunities and to help her think about recognizing opportunities.
And the notion of balancing present with the future. How many young parents are constantly concerned about what behavior might mean 10 years from now?
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about presence, and let's talk about the idea of balancing it, just our thoughts, even our conscious thought, so that we can find that kind of that pocket, that moment.
Well, there again, it's our culture saying that if you don't punish, then they'll grow up spoiled and so on. The opposite is true, you know. If we punish, then when they get big enough and old enough, they'll retaliate. They'll be full of revenge.
And if not,
I was lucky enough to learn about attachment parenting, and now I'm reaping the benefits all these years. So.
And Barb, I know Barb, you meditate, and you have such a wonderful, perspective on this, just in the ways that you finding that pocket of presence for yourself has benefited you.
Oh, yes. I mean, just again, going back to the whole paradigm of balance for yourself is to create those meaningful minutes of time, grabbing them. You know, when you've got an infant, sometimes my meditation would be while I was sitting nursing my baby. You know, that just became a very powerful time of stillness and bliss and joy. And then, you know, as they get older and things are so chaotic, you have to consciously find those times or create those times where this is mommy's time, you know, going to be in my little space for a few minutes, just to regroup again, get centered again, find your peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important. And I'd also like to mention two other ways that can bring some sense of quiet to the parent and at the same time help the child. One is through massage, baby massage.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. Really, really helpful for infants, and parents have told me that I wish I'd known about it. I didn't know about it. But the parents have told me that how it not only helps the child to relax, but then that in turn helps the parent to relax and so on. It becomes an upward spiral that way. And the other thing I'd like to mention is something that I recommend highly to all of my clients, which is called sleep talking. Talking is
that
simply talking to your child while they're asleep.
I read about the work of Lois Haddad.
Yeah, Lois Haddad has written a book, and Rodora Diaz, who is a pediatrician in the Philippines, is writing a book. She's phenomenal. She's the one who got me interested in sleep talking.
No, I can endorse that because I've done it with my kids, and it's remarkable.
It is. It really gets through to the child on a very deep and profound basis.
Jen,
they will often repeat verbatim what was said to them.
Because I don't think most people don't know what that is. And so
okay, it's simply talking to the child while they're asleep, waiting until you're sure they are asleep. Lois Haddad thinks that rapid eye movement is maybe the best time. I'll just talk real quickly about the first time I used it with Jason. He was very, very little. He was maybe 11 weeks old, and I know what the problem was. I was eating chocolate, and chocolate tends to cause wakefulness during the night. So he would get that. It's a kind of a caffeine-like chemical in chocolate, and which he would get during the nighttime nurse, and then that would wake him up later, and what would he do but nurse to get back to sleep, and that would get more of it. And, you know, I was creating a vicious cycle for myself, but I didn't know what the problem was. Anyway, he started nursing, every 7 minutes all night for three nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a zombie. I was telling a neighbor about it, and she didn't ask me if I was eating chocolate, unfortunately, but she did suggest sleep talking. She said, wait till he falls asleep, tell him what you just told me, and ask him for help. And that's what I did. As soon as he fell asleep, I said, Jason, I don't know what the problem is, so I can't help you, but I'm exhausted. I really need some rest. And he slept straight through the night. Wow. And I was amazed because I didn't question it would get through to him. I knew that adults in coma, you know, report back later what was said around them. I wasn't sure how much an 11-week-old baby would understand English, but I don't think it's on a language level. I think it's on a heart-to-heart level.
He felt what you were in need.
He sensed what I was asking for.
I've done it with my children. My kids are 7 and 10, and the first time I tried sleep talk was probably maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I was amazed at what it, the results of it. And, you know, actually, it opened up a different avenue for me in my mind, because I thought, gosh, you know, for so many years, parents are sort of conditioned by this culture to get their kids to sleep so they can have their own time. And it's almost like the kids are out. They're down and out. Well, imagine what a whole new world this opens up, that we can keep communicating with our kids even when they're asleep.
Yeah, and you can communicate during sleep talking so much easier than during the day, because you can talk about anything. I've had several clients who found it really helpful if they were going through a divorce, for example, that they found that they could explain to the child what was going on, reassure the child that it wasn't their fault, reassure the child that they were both going to be there for them later, that they would spend as much time as possible of whatever the child wanted, and so on. And those parents said that the child was so much more calm after that sleep talking.
I know, and I know one of the things that Lois Haddad emphasizes, and I know we're getting into this a little bit, and we'll switch out before we wrap up, but that the sleep talk never be negative. In other words, it's never you aren't or you don't, but more of I love how
you what you want. Yeah, I love. Yeah,
it's basically the affirmation.
Yeah, Rhodora has a if you just put Rhodora, R-H-O-D-O-R-A, and Sweet Talk in Google, you'll find her website. I can't think what it's called right now. But she writes scripts for her patients, and her scripts are very short, just a few minutes, starting and ending with a love statement. And in the middle is what you want to ask about, and she emphasizes being positive, to talk about what you do want, not what you don't want, and so on.
Right.
And it's really helpful to ask the child, if you're not sure what's going on, you can say, you know, I've been noticing that you've been sort of nervous lately. Can you find a way tomorrow to let me know how I can help?
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a real breakthrough for a lot of parents, just that one question.
So look at all of the really powerful ways of trying to explore balance, search it out, look for it, invite it, and so that it really expands the discussion beyond do you have it or do you not have it.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about a constant work in progress and a constant process of balancing.
Right.
And
it is parenting is a process.
Of course, parenting is a process and a pilgrimage. But the idea of balance, you know, this subject that so many parents are coveting and yearning for, this balance, when really it is already there in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the chaos, it's just still part of finding order, finding that calm, you know. Barb, I'd like to wrap up by promoting everybody's books and projects, and of course Attachment Parenting International has these marvelous teleseminars monthly with luminary voices, and we've been so thrilled to talk with Jan Hunt, who does worldwide counseling. She has a marvelous website, naturalchild.org, and she has 3 books out. She's got all kinds of interesting things, both for sale, resources, and ways to donate to her project, and fantastic library of articles. I mean, if you want to read more from Elliot Barker, Alfie Cohn, and even Jan herself, there's a lot to do on the site and stay and keep revisiting. And of course, Jan is available for counseling as well, and you can find her on naturalchild.org. And Barb, your book continues to just tickle people. I'm so thrilled that you and Lisa finally birthed it after all this time.
I do.
Attached at the Heart. It just got published a few months ago. And it is doing beautifully. And if people have not picked up their copy who are listening, please do. It's just got a wealth of information, insight, and inspiration for the ride. And, of course, attachmentparenting.org has marvelous resources and community for all of you.
I just want to say real quickly that how much we've appreciated Jan through the years, and she's been on our advisory board from the very beginning and has been a wonderful support and resource for all of us. Thank you so much, Jan.
Great. All right. Well, please join us next month. We have, at this point, we don't know exactly who it is, but it'll be a mystery guest. Mystery guest. But we're always thrilled to talk with people like you, Jan. It's just been wonderful. And, of course, we'd love to invite you back for another subject because you have so much to share, and we want to be able to share that with the API.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Great. All right. Well, thank you, ladies. This was fun and really informative. And
thank you, Lou.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks, Barb and Lou.
Okay. Bye for now.
Talk soon, Jan. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.